Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Jonah Goldberg is with us today, a nationally known conservative commentator, a regular on NPR, senior editor at National Review, and syndicated columnist whose work appears in many newspapers, including the Union Leader. Goldberg was in Concord last night, giving the keynote speech at the Josiah Bartlett Center's annual dinner. The center describes Goldberg as one of the most influential voices in American conservatism. In this hour, we'll hear Goldberg's thoughts on the state of that movement, as well as themes from his new book titled Suicide of the West. As always, we welcome your comments. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. And Jonah Goldberg, I hear you in Morning Edition all the time. It's really fun to meet you. Welcome to New Hampshire.
It is great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about some of the daily headlines concerning President Trump's top associates meeting with more legal trouble, his former personal lawyer Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, former campaign chairman. You know all this, Jonah. There's been a steady drip, drip, drip of news for weeks, months about this. What's your reaction, though, to these latest concerns?
I think they're bad, not to use a technical political science term. I think they demonstrate that a lot of the stories that have come out of the White House over the last year, 18 months, are now no longer operative. And I think the White House is in real trouble. That doesn't mean I think necessarily Donald Trump will be impeached. And if impeached, that doesn't necessarily mean he'll be removed. But normal administrations, and this is not a normal administration, vast swaths of the White House staff jobs have still not been filled. And they have a very hard time finding people to fill them, very hard time to find what is considered the plum job in American politics at the staff level, which is the White House chief of staff job. And people don't want it, which I think is a very bad sign, sort of, in terms of criminology about what's going on. And but normal White Houses have been devastated when the other party had the scent of blood and got control of subpoena power and committees in the House. And so the Democrats, whether or not they ever pursue impeachment, have so many lines of inquiry, from emolument stuff to the stuff out of the Mueller probe, that in some ways, I don't think what people realize, and I don't think Donald Trump realizes, Robert Mueller is increasingly becoming irrelevant to this process. If Donald Trump fired him tomorrow, he'd be the first witness called by the Democratic House, and he would be ordered to produce everything he's doing.
Because Democrats have taken over?
Because Democrats have taken over, and so you can't contain it anymore by firing him even if you wanted to. And also, Mueller, I think, probably shrewdly, from his perspective, whether or not you agree with what he's doing and all that is a different question, he farmed out big chunks of all of this to the Southern District of New York and to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Virginia, which means if you fire Mueller, that stuff keeps going. And so I think we've reached contagion level. You can no longer contain what's going on, and all of 2019 is going to be full of this. So not to be too depressing, it's all going to get dumber.
Well, so here's the thing, though. You know, you said 2019 is going to be even more full of this. Uh-huh. 2018 certainly has been full of this. What about the broader public, Jonah? This, you know, constant drip, drip, drip of, you know, Mueller and Cohen, and we're just hearing about it all the time. At some point, do people just say, eh, and tune out?
I think that's largely happened. And I think that
already,
for a large number of people, to be sure. But it also fits into some sort of larger trends in the culture where more and more people get their news from the sources that they already agree with. And very few people are interested in getting out of their lane or out of their channel and hearing information that doesn't already comport with what they believe.
Sure. So, we've heard this for a while.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a Fox News contributor. I can't really defend a lot of the stuff that's on the opinion side anymore because I just think it's gone off the rails. But on the news side, I'm still willing to defend it. But at the end of the day, still in terms of the people that people are hearing at Fox, you would think the Mueller probe has found nothing, has been a huge waste of time, is taking forever. And if you watch MSNBC, you'll hear we're 10 seconds from impeachment. Everything's about to go down. And so it's even different from what it was 20 years ago, where a lot of people tuned out the Clinton scandals. But even back then, there was still something like of a national news culture. And I think everyone is in their silos right now, so it makes it even easier to dismiss information that you don't like or don't want to hear.
Interesting. So you said a moment ago, Jonah, that, when I asked you for your reaction to these latest revelations, you said this means that the stories coming out of the White House are not operative. What do you mean by that?
The stories that have been.
There's
10 stages of denial that Donald Trump goes through, where first of all, he says it didn't happen. There's nothing there. Then he says, if it did happen, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, and he goes through all of these kinds of things. He's still, as far as I know, officially the line is he never had any relationship with Stormy Daniels. He never had a relationship with the Playboy model. I think that's probably very hard to sustain anymore. He says that I had never told Cohen to do anything. That right now is he said, she said, or he said, he said. But my guess is that Mueller and Cohen was a notorious taper. He recorded a lot of conversations. He was a pack rat with records. The Mueller people have all of these text messages, all of these phone logs. My guess is that while Cohen is perfectly capable of lying about a lot of things, if Mueller believes Cohen's version of these events, it's because there's outside evidence to corroborate it. And that suggests that, you know, look, the Southern District of New York has charged the president of the United States in willfully ordering a felony to be committed. That's a big deal. And we can get into the hothouse atmosphere of screaming back and forth. The fact is, at some point, this is going to go before a judge or a congressional hearing, and we're going to see the facts. And it's rare that the facts are always on the side of Donald Trump in these things.
What's the impact, Jonah, of people tuning it out? Or if they're not tuning it out, they're listening to Fox and saying it's much ado about nothing, or they're listening to MSNBC and saying, as you said, we're 10 seconds from impeachment. What's the impact of that sort of three different reactions?
Yeah. So, as I argue in my book, a lot of the things that we're seeing in the moment through the fishbowl are really symptoms of larger problems that have a much longer tail to them. And we live in this moment of what political scientists call negative polarization or negative partisanship. And what that basically means is a huge number of Democrats call themselves Democrats basically just because they hate Republicans. And a huge number of Republicans are Republicans because they hate Democrats. They define themselves in terms of opposition to the other, which is a very tribal, normal way for our minds to work. It's just not the way they're supposed to work in an advanced civilization. And so, like, my wife got my favorite New Yorker cartoon blown up and framed for me. And it has two dogs drinking martinis at a bar in New York in suits. And one dog says to the other, you know, it's not good enough that dogs succeed. Cats must also fail. And so I think that is the atmosphere that we're in today, where no side wants to give even the slightest quarter to the other side in any of these fights. It's got to be totally zero sum. We win, they lose. And that's the impact of this, is that for the people who are disengaged, who are just, I don't want to hear it anymore, it's sort of like the poem, the best lack all conviction. They're just tuning it out. And so the people who are the most invested, either psychologically or politically or otherwise, are the ones least likely to compromise or admit the other side has a point about anything. So I just think things are going to get more polarized as the years go by.
Well, since you mentioned the book, let me just remind listeners, the title is Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of Tribalism, Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. The author is Jonah Goldberg. You probably heard him on Morning Edition many times. He's also an author, syndicated columnist, and nationally known conservative commentator. He was in Concord last night giving the keynote speech at the Josiah Bartlett Center's annual dinner. And he joins us now, and let's hear from you. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number 1-800-892-6477. 6477. So, Joan, just a couple more questions about some of the news that we've been hearing, and then I do want to talk about some of the themes in the book. You said on Morning Edition yesterday, after all these revelations came out over the weekend, that you expect to see more and more distance between prominent Republicans and the White House. Have you seen it yet?
We've seen it on some policy things, like the murder of Khashoggi. A bunch of Republicans took a different line on that. Maybe not as hard a line as I would like, but they took a different line. Haven't seen it quite yet. I got to admit, there were some statements from Orrin Hatch today that I thought were really unfortunate.
We've got those statements, actually. Okay. I mean, to interrupt you, because I was listening to a lot of the quotes from top Republican officials, Kevin McCarthy, Rand Paul, although he's not really a top Republican official, but a Republican, Orrin Hatch. And I'm not hearing yet that distance, but let's hear what Orrin Hatch said.
President Trump, before he became president, that's another world. Since he's become president, this economy has charged ahead. We're all better off. The country's better off. And he's done a whale of a job. And I think we ought to judge him on that basis rather than trying to drum up things from the past that may or may not be true.
And again, that audio courtesy of CNN, that's Senator Orrin Hatch. So doesn't sound like a lot of distance there, Jonah.
No, it doesn't. And there was some other stuff that wasn't in that clip about how he was trying to pin this all on the Democrats. And then it was pointed out to him that this filing came from a Trump appointee-led U.S. District Attorney's Office in New York. What I find particularly disappointing, I like Orrin Hatch a lot. I think he's an honorable, decent man. He's retiring. There is no political incentive for him right now to be covering for him, for anybody like this. And, you know, history is going to look back and they're going to see one of the last things that Orrin Hatch did was do this kind of spin that was totally gratuitous, unnecessary, and totally contradictory with the positions he took 20 years ago. And then Mitt Romney comes in and he's going to take a different tack. And I think and believe he'll take a different tack and be more critical. He doesn't need to do this. He's going to go home to Utah and collect gold watches and gavels for the rest of his retirement. And that's great. And he should. And he should be celebrated. Why turn into, a late night cable news spinner on your way out the door? And I find it sad.
So why have people like Orrin Hatch and Kevin McCarthy and Rand Paul and a couple others said, you know, kind of like what we heard from Senator Hatch there, it may or may not be true. It's dredged up from the past. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, well, we always should allow for the possibility that some of them actually believe what they're saying. Some possibility that they believe what they're saying. Well, look, part of it is that the base of the Republican Party is still all in behind Trump, and part because of this negative polarization stuff. When you talk to people, grassroots conservatives, away from cameras, not on the record, they will concede a lot of the unseemliness of the Trump administration. But they think that giving an inch on any of this stuff is just feeding the Democrats, and this sort of binary zero-sum mentality is all over the place. So there's a political incentive right now to stick with the president. I also think they're all probably just waiting for a few more facts to come out. But I stand by what I predicted yesterday on Morning Edition. I think over time, the fact that the facts are not going, when the facts continue not to go his way, you'll see more and more distance. Look, Nick Ayers, who I don't know personally, was Mike Pence's chief of staff, was offered the job of chief of staff in the White House. That is his dream job. And I understand he's got young kids and all of that, but if things were going swimmingly with the Trump administration, I don't think he would have opted to instead pull his kids out of school and go home to Georgia in the middle of the school year. I think there are a lot of people who do not want to have, who are realizing that their long-term political prospects might look better with a little distance from the Trump White House than hugging it.
In a little bit later, John, I want to ask you about the presidential campaign because we've seen a lot of Democrats here in New Hampshire and some Republicans, including Jeff Flake, who's retiring, and John Kasich of Ohio. But a little bit more on congressional Republicans, if I could, please. In D.C. today at a think tank I'm sure you know well, the Niskanen Institute, fair to call them a conservative think tank.
They're a little quirky.
Founded
they're
by
more like
Reagan and
yeah,
during the Reagan era.
But they are. A libertarian, but also sort of a very technocratic group. They're much more sort of hands-on than, say, Cato. They got great people there, but they're more culturally liberal than you might think.
Interesting. So. Okay, so good clarification. They're holding a strategy session today called Starting Over, the Center-Right After Trump, Some of your fellow leading D.C. conservative thinkers will be there. You know, people you often appear
on
panels and so forth. You're not there physically, obviously. You're here with us. Are you there in spirit?
Yes and no. You know, I don't call myself a never Trumper anymore, in part because my definition of never Trump was I wasn't going to vote for him, and I wasn't going to endorse him, and I wasn't going to lie for him. Two of those things are no longer operative. I have no opportunity to vote for him. I don't ever really cared much about my vote. I live in Washington, D.C. I've never lived anywhere where my vote wasn't canceled out at least 9-1.
because you were conservative in a liberal town.
Right. I mean, I grew up in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. We were like Christians in ancient Rome. And and so the only one that's still operative is that I'm not going to lie for him. And my view is I've praised some of the things that have come out of the Trump administration. I've definitely criticized a lot of things. But one of the things that I've really sort of come to grips with is that in 2016 was a stress test for lots of people on the right about what was their primary commitment. And what I mean by that is pundits like me, we wear a lot of different hats. We're kind of we're syndicated columnists, we're TV talking heads, we give speeches, we write books, we're conservative intellectuals, but we're also sort of party people. We're sort of cheerleaders, but we're also critics, right? And for most of my professional life, all of those things weren't in much conflict with each other.
You can kind of wear all those hats at once.
You can wear them all at once. In 2016, everyone was asked, take off all your hats but one. And a bunch of my friends decided that at the end of the day, the one hat they weren't going to take off was the party hat, was the GOP hat. Some of them were honest about it. Some of them weren't. But at the end of the day, they were like, I'm here to help the Republican Party. I've never seen my job that way. I obviously prefer the Republican Party to the Democratic Party historically because it's more conservative than the two parties, but I'm not a party guy. I'm very proud to call myself a conservative. And so the one thing I wouldn't do is lie. And at the end of the day, conservatism for me boils down to two things. If you strip it of all the philosophy and the prudential questions, it's the idea that ideas matter, right? That through logic and reason and persuasion based in the Enlightenment that we can reach better optimal policies. And the idea that character matters. And Donald Trump is a man of bad character. And no one has been able to give me a definition of good character that Donald Trump can clear. My problem with what's going on in the Scannon Center, I shouldn't say a problem, but the reason I hold some of that stuff at a distance, Bill Kristol's a very good friend of mine. I've known him for a long time.
He's one of the speakers. And
I know he's often in New Hampshire. He might even get his mail these days. But I'm also not a party activist, right? I don't work within the party. I don't try to build new institutions within the party. My job is to tell the truth as I see it. And I think Bill at times has gotten over his skis being too much of a player in the politics of this rather than an observer of it. But that's always sort of been his role. He's always had one foot in the inter-party squabbles and whatnot. I've never done that. I'm much happier to sit at home like Howard Hughes with Kleenex boxes on my feet and, you know, scream at clouds.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Let's talk about some of those policies then. Again, you said that you like to stick to the ideals and the conservative policies. One of those, for Republicans, at least for a long time, has been free trade. Another is concern about deficits. What's your take, Jonah, on how congressional Republicans, House and Senate, have responded to some of these policies, which, by the way, they're hearing from allies in the business community about free trade, for example?
Yeah. I'm a free trader. And I think that, look, one of the reasons why I fought so hard against Trump in the primaries, and one of the reasons why I've sort of held his feet to the fire in all this, is that I think that Donald Trump, in many ways, if you can get past all of the reasons why he enrages individual liberals for understandable reasons, actually represents a turn leftward in many ways. He's a statist. He's a crony capitalist. He thinks that he is smarter than the market. He thinks he can pick winners and losers. His winners are different than the left's winners, right? So, like, Barack Obama picked winners and losers, but it was wind and solar. And Donald Trump picks coal and oil.
Although Barack Obama also bailed out the auto industry, right?
He did.
In one sense, they both picked the auto industry. But go ahead.
Yeah, that's fine. That sort of goes to my point, is I'm not a big fan of crony capitalism, and I don't care if it benefits the right-wing coalition or the left-wing coalition. And so, and on the debt stuff, you know, what he has done on the debt, on trade, on a lot of things, is take essentially many Democratic positions and now make them bipartisan. And the one that actually breaks my heart the most isn't stuff about trade and deficits, even though that all really matters to me. It's on the identity politics front. The left has been pushing this understanding of identity politics that you can reduce people to their race or their gender for a very long time. And Trump has unleashed forces. He's not articulate enough to do it well himself, but the way he talks about nationalism, the way he talks about his people, the way his people talk about him and their movement, we are seeing the right surrender to a kind of identity politics as well that says or implies white America is the real America, that Christians are the real Americans. And that breaks my heart because that means that the sort of disdain for the principles of the American founding is becoming more bipartisan. And it leaves me with no political home. People always ask me, what is it like to be politically or ideologically homeless? And I say, I'm not ideologically homeless. I've never been more ideologically grounded. What I am is politically homeless. I don't have a natural constituency anymore. I've lost a lot of friends. I've lost a lot of fans. But
You've lost a lot of friends and fans? I mean, fans I can see. Fandom comes and goes. But you've lost friends over this?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really?
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
I mean, no friends that matter on a huge level, right? I mean, no close friend of mine is going to get between this. But there are lots of people who think, you know, I've been a traitor. You know, that this is heresy. You know, you need to support the party. The election's over. It was a binary choice. Hillary is terrible, yada, yada, yada. I hear a lot of – one of the things that, you know, I was talking earlier about the hats, taking off the hat stuff. Heard from a lot of people who were disappointed in me that I didn't live down to their expectations. They just
live
sort of
– down to.
Yeah. They expected at the end of the day, you know, I understand primaries can be rough, but we've got the nominee now, so you have to support him. And I was like, no, I don't. I don't work for the RNC. I'm not a, you know, delegate from New Hampshire who's a Republican, you know, party guy. I'm a writer, and my job is to tell the truth as I see it. And this caused a lot of friction. There are a lot of people who consider it disloyal to sort of criticize other people who are following the party line. It makes the green room at Fox very uncomfortable at times.
Democrats do that too, don't they? Sort of all get behind their guy.
Absolutely.
Whether it's Obama or Clinton or whoever.
Absolutely. This is a larger point of my book is that we are wired. We evolved in a natural environment to live as what we call tribally, right? The neuroscientists call it the coalition instinct. We are naturally form these social networks. And that's what politics largely is about. It's just the politics is breaking down and it's getting much more tribal.
I want to pick up on that theme after a short break, Jonah, because that's an important point that you raise in your book. And we'll start taking your calls, emails. You can send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. Today, we're talking with Jonah Goldberg, prominent conservative writer and analyst, on Trumpism, tribalism, and the future of the GOP. His new book is called Suicide of the West. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Exchange listeners, by the way, as 2018 comes to a close, we're voting on our top shows of the year. Now, the Exchange team has chosen 10 shows. We'd like you to vote on 5, and then the winners will air during the holiday week. So go ahead and cast your vote. You can find the survey at nhpr.org/exchange. You can give us a call right now and talk with Jonah Goldberg. Again, the title of his book is Suicide of the West. The subtitle is How the Rebirth of Tribalism, Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And Jonah, before we go to our listeners, I want to pick up on something you said a little bit earlier, and it has to do with that subtitle, this idea of tribalism. You accused liberals of doing it. You said it breaks your heart now that conservatives are doing it. Just kind of sort that out for us and what the problem with tribalism is.
Sure. I mean, look, there is honestly nothing wrong with tribalism in the sense that there's nothing wrong with cloudy days. They just are a fact of nature, right? We are wired, we evolved to live in a tribal way. The question is, how do you channel human nature in productive ways? A big part of the argument in my book is that the system of civilizing people, starting with the family, but also going out to mediating institutions, churches, schools, local communities, that those sort of organs of the body politic are breaking down. And so what is happening is, and whenever that happens throughout history, we knew this from street gangs and the Irish slums to the Crips and the Bloods, that when people aren't properly socialized, they revert back to human nature. That's the story of Lord of the Flies. These incredibly refined little kids from boarding school in England, you drop them on an island without adult supervision. 5 minutes later, they got spears and war paint and they're worshiping a devil god. Human nature exists, and what you have to do is channel in productive ways. And all of the ways that we normally do that are breaking down. And so instead, what's happening is we're looking to Washington for cure-alls that come from charismatic, messianic political leaders. Barack Obama very much campaigned that way. He posed himself the way. Donald Trump, I alone can fix it, basically came in like a man on a white horse. And then there are these other social factors, things like Facebook, where we're retreating from real organic communities and instead joining up in virtual communities, which are not real communities. And when you go on places like Facebook or you turn on cable TV, you have all of your worst prejudices and biases confirmed rather than challenged. And it becomes sort of the centrifugal force where people are purifying into these abstract tribal groups where they get most of their meaning now from politics. The number of people in America now who get more meaning and their behavior is easier to predict because of their partisan affiliation rather than their race, ethnicity, religion, all that is astounding. We are turning politics into essentially a virtual ethnicity in this country, and it's an ethnicity that hates the other ethnicity. And that is a mess that is way upstream of Washington. Donald Trump didn't create it. He feeds off of it, but it's not his fault. He's maybe making it worse, but these are longer-term trends in the culture that are really dangerous and really disturbing.
So as traditional civic organizations break down, you know, churches or bowling leagues or whatever you want to call it,
right,
people seek comfort in the tribe, and it becomes easier and easier. And there are people who are feeding off of that that uncertainty and seeking it in these comfortable political spaces.
Right. So we all have what the sociologist Robert Nisbet called a quest for community. We want to belong.
Sure. And that's human nature.
That's human
nature.
And it's
a very
great
beginning.
And it's a wonderful thing about human nature, right? And we all want to be loved. We all want to have the sense of meaning and belonging, and that if we were gone tomorrow, we would be missed. And the problem is increasingly is that we're losing places to find that where we actually live. And so we are starting to look to politics or commercial brands or celebrities. I mean, the sort of cult of various celebrities is the same sort of thing. We're trying to find meaning in abstract, weird fashions. We're trying to wear, you know, the desire to sort of be defined by your tattoos or these superficial attributes rather than being defined by who loves you and who you love. This is a huge problem. Ben Sasse is the senator from Nebraska, has a wonderful book on this called Them. And this is all natural, that because humans want to have these attachments, if we can't find them in healthy places, we look for them in unhealthy places. This is the story of lots of dysfunctional people who have bad lives. And one of the things we're doing in our life now, in our society, is the people who are looking for more and more of that, they're looking to Washington or they're looking to politics to provide it. On the flip side, there are lots of people who are doing perfectly fine, and what they're doing is they're watching politics like it's a form of entertainment. And weird things happen to your brain when you watch entertainment. When you watch a movie, as long as you like the hero, he can murder, he can rape, he can kill, as long as he's doing it towards a worthy end because you've invested in the hero. The same thing, they do these wonderful studies where they ask a guy, they bring in an observer to look through a two-way mirror at someone wired with electrodes, and they'll shock them. They'll shock the person in the electrodes, and the person watching, the empathetic parts of his brain will light up. They'll imagine
sure.
It was them, and they're, oh my God.
Yeah, how terrible.
And they'll then say to him, hey, you're a New England Patriots fan. That guy is a Giants fan. And when they shock them, the pleasure centers of their brain light up. And so much of the way we do political discourse, and what breaks my heart is to see it on the right so much, is this idea that something it's worth being a jerk so long as it makes the right people angry.
Well, this gets to your earlier point that you got into a lot of trouble when you came out as a leading conservative thinker against the president. But you said, look, I'm not a party guy.
Right.
I'm an analyst, an author, a writer, and so forth. Lots of people jumping into our conversation,
sure.
Jonas. I'd love to go to them. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the Exchange, a wide-ranging political discussion with Jonah Goldberg. He's an author. He's a columnist, senior editor of National Review. He was in Concord last night, speaking before the Josiah Bartlett Center. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange@nhpr.org. Julia writes, Jonah's comments about political polarization are spot on. The only solution is to change how we vote. When candidates can win with 40% of the vote, these are the candidates that represent the most divisive voters and will only govern for these voters. Maine just had great success with ranked choice voting. We should implement it or approve voting nationwide for all elections. So, Julia, thank you so much for the comments. I'm wondering, do you get into some of these more mechanics of voting in your book, Jonah?
No, I don't. I you know, the book starts 250,000 years ago, so there's only so much you can include. I certainly think that there are reforms in voting and our electoral processes that I would be in favor of. I look at ranked choice voting, and I think it's interesting. I'm not 100% convinced yet, but I'm also intrigued by it.
Yeah, we did a show on it a while ago.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
the experiment is still out there.
You do get the thing is, it's very easy whenever there's some reform that's starting to be implemented, is you can look at the bad examples, you know, the anomalies that happen. With every system, there are going to be some bad outcomes. And the trick is whether you decide whether or not those are going to define it or whether those are sort of the outliers. And I just don't know yet.
This leads naturally into a question about the Electoral College. You've had in recent elections two winners who did not receive the popular vote. I just wonder what your thoughts are, Joan, as a longtime political observer on the Electoral College.
Yeah, so I'm a little off the reservation on all this stuff. I like the Electoral College. I think that if you want to get rid of the Electoral College, say so, right, rather than some of the stuff that we're hearing out of Washington about all sorts of cockamamie ideas about giving certain states more senators and how the Senate is bankrupt. If we got rid of the Electoral College, you would never see a presidential candidate come to New Hampshire again, right? And you would instead get people running in giant population centers, and you would have the president from the three largest – president of the United States would represent the three or four largest cities in the country.
Sure, and that's the argument, and I've heard it. On the other hand, you know, we are at some – you know, at some point we're Californians. People say, would you want Californians and New Yorkers and Texans to decide the presidency? But at some level, they're also Americans.
Oh, sure, sure,
so the way we have it now, more Americans' choice isn't being put in the White House.
No, I agree.
So I just wonder how you get around that.
Yeah, well, it sort of depends when people want to which problem people want to identify. When people say the Senate is unrepresentative or undemocratic, I think that's nonsense. Senators are elected democratically within their states, and if you think that the lack of representation in the Senate for California is a problem, break up California, right? I do think the first op-ed I ever wrote appeared in the Wall Street Journal in 1992, the day after the election. Was on why we should expand the House of Representatives.
Wow, it's pretty big already.
It basically stopped at 435. I mean, I'm being a little facetious here, but because the fire marshal said so, right? The size of your average House district now is larger than the population of most states when the country was created.
Well, and breaking up California from a small state perspective like New Hampshire, sure. I mean, how many New Hampshires would fit in California?
A
like
great many.
20,
like,
30?
Yeah, so. Something like that.
Well, since we're in New Hampshire, uh-huh. I do have a lot of questions about the presidential campaign.
Sure.
So, Julia, thank you so much for that email. And by the way, keep the emails coming. This is great. exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. Garrett writes, I happen to be reading and enjoying Suicide of the West. Jonah, Garrett asks, any chance of John Kasich mounting a primary challenge to President Trump? Garrett, thank you so much. You know, I hinted at this earlier, Jonah. We've seen a fair number of Democrats making their way through, but on the Republican side, we've just seen John Kasich and Jeff Flake.
Yeah.
So what do you think about Garrett's question?
First of all, thanks for getting the book, Garrett. I think it's very likely that John Kasich mounts a primary challenge, and I think it's also very likely that if he launches a primary challenge, he will lose. Historically, most primary challenges to sitting presidents fail. Even the one that knocked Lyndon Johnson out of the race, Lyndon Johnson actually won. He just didn't win by a non-embarrassing margin. But even so, they usually have their effect by fueling and galvanizing the populist base of their party. Pat Buchanan in 92.
Peasants with pitchforks.
Right.
I remember that.
That is the one slice of the Republican coalition Donald Trump is holding on to. And so the idea that John Kasich is going to lead some grand army of raging moderates to take back the White House, I'll believe it when I see it. I don't particularly love the way John Kasich does politics, but if you could tell me that a Republican, a decent, serious conservative Republican, could primary Donald Trump and do it successfully, I would be entirely in favor of that.
Do you think there is a Republican out there who could mount a successful primary challenge to the president?
I think the only ones who conceivably could do it, well, again, successful is a very high bar, right? It usually does. I can't think.
I was thinking win the nomination.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to see. And the only ones who conceivably could do it wouldn't do it precisely because they have a future in the Republican Party, right? I mean, if Nikki Haley, who, full disclosure, my wife worked for, if she wanted to do it, she could do some terrific damage to Donald Trump, but she's not going to do that. And I have no inside information about all this. It's just common sense. If you think you've got a long-term future in the Republican Party, why would you enrage half or a third of the party by doing something like that and handing the election to the Democrats?
So you think Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee in 2020?
I think if he seeks re-election and is not otherwise indisposed, yeah. If he wants it and he's still around, he will be the nominee. I'm not convinced he runs again. I'm not convinced he doesn't. You hear different things.
Well, and 2 years is a long time
it
in
is.
Politics. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Here's another email, this one from Ray. Does Mr. Goldberg actually think Mr. Trump is qualified and competent to be president of the United States? If yes, what makes him qualified and competent? If no, what makes him unqualified? Wow, that's a big question, Ray. Thank you.
I certainly believed while he was still running, certainly in the primaries, that he was not qualified to be president of the United States. I have not seen a lot to change my position on that. This is a debate that drives me a little crazy. I hear from a lot of pro-Trump people who say, well, look at all the great things that are happening because of him. There are a handful of things I think you actually can attribute to purely to Donald Trump that only Donald Trump could have done. And most of those conservatives understand are good things, or see as good things. But enormous amount of the things that Republicans and conservatives consider successes in this administration were done more despite him rather than because of him.
So in terms of qualifications, to Ray's point, why not have a businessman come in? I mean, is it the fact that he didn't have political experience that you think made him unqualified?
I have a problem with businessmen who say, I'm just going to bring my skills running a big corporation to the...
Because we hear that a lot.
You hear a lot. And it's...
Senate candidates, gubernatorial candidates.
I've written about this for years. It's a different skill set. The way you build consensus is very, very different when you're the CEO and it's everyone's paid job to listen to you. When you have a whole bunch of people who answer to voters in their own states and not to you, it's much more difficult to do it. Politics is a different skill set than business. But Donald Trump is not your normal businessman. He's much more of a marketer and a huckster. In a lot of ways, he's a black swan. Most billionaires I know of don't think it's worth their time to do YouTube commercials hawking steaks or selling vitamin supplements or building up bogus universities. He's one of these guys who managed to get rich despite the fact that he did not act with integrity in the business world. And so I have no, as a category, I don't have a blanket opposition to any businessman becoming president of the United States. But it's this man that I think had, he was a reality show star. And he runs the White House like he's a reality show star. And the people in his administration who are getting a lot of things done that I am in favor of, I think are doing it despite the fact that the president is sometimes his own worst enemy.
So experience in business, you know, not a blanket statement, never, ever, but it doesn't translate. That skill set doesn't often translate well to running a political and government organization.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, again, take Donald Trump out of it. That's just a generically true statement. Herbert Hoover was a great businessman. He struggled to deal with some things as a president. Mitt Romney was a great businessman, but his political skill set needed some work. I think we can all agree on, even though I'm a big admirer of Mitt Romney's. It's just there are lots of businessmen. I hear this all the time from the business community. They say, well, we'll just get in a room. We'll get everybody together and we'll just come to a conclusion. That's so much easier when you're talking about the division vice presidents of a company you run, where you're all motivated by the profit motive, by shareholder price, and we all are ultimately answerable to a single person. Senators are not and should not be answerable to the President of the United States. It's a different branch of government.
Here's another email. This is from Christopher, who says, I used to have CNN on from dawn till dusk, save for Howie Kurtz and Chris Wallace on Fox and Morning Joe first thing each day on MSNBC. I now find CNN barely watchable. The anchors are pretty much now all commentators. Morning Joe is tiresome from the get-go, Christopher says. Subsequently, he says, I'm tuned into C-SPAN more and more. Their Washington Journal program welcomes callers from across the ideological perspective. Very refreshing. Christopher also says, I enjoy your column in the Union Leader, Jonah. I like his description of himself as an intellectual conservative. This gets to the earlier point that you said that people are just watching their own favorite media streams.
Yeah, and to his point, I mean, I don't want to denigrate any more than I already have these various cable networks, but one of the weird ironies about the moment we're in is that we've never been more partisan, but the parties have never been weaker. And so there are all these institutions outside of the party structure that are doing the work of parties, informing voters, framing issues, vetting candidates, and sometimes news anchors, journalists, they get confused about whether or not they're supposed to be, observers or whether they're in the arena.
All right. That's really interesting. And that's another theme from this book, Suicide of the West, that we'll pick up on after a short break. So keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Listen to NHPR for reporting that you trust and for award-winning journalism that's available to everyone in your community. I'm Rick Ganley, host of Morning Edition, and when you donate to NHPR today, you can extend your generosity by giving meals to the New Hampshire Food Bank. Contribute $10 a month and pay forward your thank you gift. Instead of choosing a mug or a t-shirt, choose to give 10 meals to the food bank. Give today and pay it forward at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Jonah Goldberg is with us, prominent conservative writer and analyst. We're talking politics and some of the themes in his new book, Suicide of the West. We've been hearing from you, too. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And just a quick note to Exchange listeners, as the year comes to an end, we'd love your help on picking our top shows of the year. Now, the Exchange team has chosen 10 that we really liked, but help us pick the top 5, and we'll air those during the holiday week. You can find the survey at nhpr.org/exchange. Again, you can send us an email now, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Joan, another political trend that I have noticed in my many years covering politics is more and more interest in outsiders, people who maybe don't come from the political realm, running for very high office. In our most recent campaigns here in New Hampshire, we had, more than a dozen people running for one of our congressional seats, some of whom had some experience with politics, some of whom had no experience at all, but decided to run for Congress. I just wonder what you think about this love for the outsider.
Yeah, so it depends on what level of government we're talking about. I love the New Hampshire model of sort of a citizen legislature.
Sure, and you got to get your start somewhere.
And so, yeah, I mean, everyone runs for office the first time at some point, right? So that doesn't bother me at all, really, so long as people do their homework. I mean, this is one of my great problems with all politicians who have charismatic, organic relationship with their follower, with their fans or the voters, but then don't do their homework. You know, Sarah Palin didn't do her homework. Lots of people don't do their homework. And that drives me crazy because doing the homework is the simple part. But at the presidential level, I think it's more worrisome because, you know, as I was saying about earlier about how these institutions are breaking down, faith and trust in institutions all across the board has been breaking down for the last 40 years. And last I looked, there were only two institutions in America that were above 50% popularity, the military and small businesses. But churches, schools, synagogues, media, all underwater, some in single digits.
The judiciary? I'm just
judiciary?
Curious.
Yeah, all. Yeah. And so the problem is, we talk about the parties as if they're these, you know, the system is rigged and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And Bernie Sanders is a little bit of a case because I do think he was robbed. But for the most part, the parties have never been weaker. They've never been smaller, and they're getting weaker by the day. And these outsiders are coming in claiming to be taking on this grand dragon of the establishment when it's really on its knees gasping for air. I think this country would be better off, maybe not go back to the smoke-filled rooms of the 1850s or the 1870s, but maybe the smoke-filled rooms of the 1950s and 60s. The parties need a little more power. Our institutions need a little more power to get things done. And these outsiders come in without doing their homework and promising that they can solve all of our problems because all that it takes is some Cincinnatus laying down his plow to ride in and clear everybody out. And that's not the truth of it. The truth is, this is hard. There are a lot of people in government I disagree with, but it's hard work. These are difficult policies, and claiming that it's all so easy or all so simple, and once I get in there, I'm going to fix it all, is you're selling people a bill of goods.
Everybody kind of does that, though, when they run for office, don't they? I mean,
to some extent,
who runs for office saying, well, I'm going to get in and I'll do my best, but it's going to be hard?
George H.W. Bush. George H.W. Bush was the last president who saw the job as a management position. And
people thought he was boring.
But this gets back to the point of watching politics as entertainment. What's wrong with the president being boring?
or uninspiring. How about that?
Yeah.
People want to be inspired by the president.
Look, I'm a guy who's envious of Switzerland, where lots of people don't know the name of the president. I want people to look to their local communities to be inspired. I want people to look to actual human beings they can model after. Turning presidents who are the head of one branch of one layer of government in this country into these cult of personality, charismatic figures, I think, has been the source of a lot of our problems in this country going back over 100 years. And it's not the way the country was set up. I don't like charismatic, larger-than-life leaders promising that they're going to deliver everything that we want. That's not what politics is supposed to be about in this country.
Let's take another call.
Sure.
This is Frank in Manchester. Hi, Frank. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, good morning. You folks are doing a wonderful job. I have a suggestion that New Hampshire might want to implement. Any candidate who wants to run in our primary should have to release at least the last 10 years of their federal taxes. We put that in before the next primary. If Donald Trump is still running, and I have a feeling he may not be, then he'd have to show his taxes or not run in the primary.
Is that important to you in terms of the president himself, or just broadly you think all candidates should have to do that?
Well, I think every candidate should, and as far as I know, every candidate has for at least the last 30 years. Trump has kept saying, well, as soon as the audit is done, well, we know he's a massive liar. I'm an independent, not a Democrat or Republican. I voted for the person always, but he just lies so much that nothing he says is actually truthful. I want to call his bluff, and I want to make sure that no candidate in the future is acting like he does, like I can shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and everybody would still be stupid enough to support me. We ought to call it as it is. You want to run? We want to see financially where you stand, what your background is in terms of the money you've paid to the government to help support America that you claim you love so much. So,
Frank, thank
you. Want to
you.
Run? Let's see your taxes.
Well, thanks a lot for calling in. And Jonah, what do you think about this tax return thing? Do you think it's a big deal for most
I used to not care about it much, but one of the reasons I didn't care about it much is that everybody released them. So it's just one of these, you know, formalities that candidates went through. Usually it was closer to the general election, you know, and they would time it differently. But I'm with him. I think that at least going forward, coming up with some mechanism that says you can't get the party nomination or you can't run in certain primaries unless you release your tax returns, just seems like a good way to build up the institutional power of these institutions. And look, remember, most people who run for president, they've been planning on it for a very long time. So I don't know if it has to be the last 10 years, but the last five, which would at least give you a sense of what the current obligations and potential conflicts of interest are. I really don't see a huge downside with it.
All right, Frank, thanks for the call. You can give us a call too, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You know, Jonah, we've talked a lot about national politics, and that's your specialty, so it makes sense. But I did want to get your take on a little bit more local politics. We're just a few weeks out from the midterm elections. Democrats, as you know, took back the U.S. House, made some gains in state houses. Here in New Hampshire, as you probably learned last night, speaking in Concord, the party's going to control the House, Senate, and the Executive Council. What's your take on this shift a little bit back towards Democrats in the midterm elections? It wasn't the huge blue wave, but it was good for a good night for Democrats.
Yeah, I haven't checked this myself, but a friend of mine was telling me last night that there are now more Republican governors in New England than there are Republican congressmen.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's from a Republican perspective, that should be terrifying. And so I think that one of the things we're seeing is this is all part of the big sort. California Republicans lost Orange County, which
is a very Republican stronghold.
Historically, it was Reagan and Goldwater's base of operations. And, you know, according to ancient Republican prophecy, when you lose Orange County, rivers should be turning to blood and, you know, the angel of death should be coming because that's our home base. And so what you're seeing is more and more the Republican Party is resembling a rural working class, is trying to become a working class workers party, as Steve Bannon or somebody without hooves might say. And then the Democrats are becoming an elite urban party, and the battle is over the suburbs. And right now, in this midterm, the suburbs, which there are a lot of sort of demographically in New Hampshire, they all went for the Democrats. Whether they stay with the Democrats long term is going to be the contest of the next 10 years. Whoever controls the suburbs will be the dominant party in America over the next decade. And it's not obvious to me that either party has a lock on them yet.
Well, what does it take to control the suburbs? And again, speaking as a conservative, what would you like to see conservatives do to control the suburbs?
Yeah, again, I don't want to make it sound like I'm a political consultant making these kinds of recommendations.
Sure.
But look, part of it is, look, again, I don't want to harp on Donald Trump, but Donald Trump is the first president in modern memory, maybe in the American history, who has governed as if he doesn't care about expanding his coalition. He only cares about his base. And what he forgot was that the base of the Republican Party, rather than Donald Trump, was the suburbs. Hardworking, middle class, married couples with kids trying to figure out how to pay for college. That was the sort of a big chunk of who Republicans went for and who Democrats went for. And Donald Trump pushed them away. He pushed Republican college-educated women almost vanished as a species in these midterms. And so some of the problem is figuring out a way to message in ways that doesn't scare those people away, and that's going to be very hard to do so long as Trump is in office.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. I want to ask you one more question about your book, Jonah. The title's pretty dramatic, The Suicide of the West. That's that's a word that makes some people go,
yeah.
What are you trying to do with that title?
Well, Take a Bath with a Toaster was taken. I'll admit, for years, the working title of the book was supposed to be The Tribe of Liberty. And what I was trying to make this argument that our attachment to the institutions of liberty come out of the English tradition, that they're not purely rational. The attachments come first. They're formed in family. They're formed in culture. And the rational abstract principles come later. But for various reasons, the publisher and I, we decided that wasn't the way to go with the title. And they loved Suicide of the West. I went with Suicide of the West. I don't call it the death of the West. I don't call it the end of the West. I call it Suicide of the West because as bleak as it may sound, suicide's still a choice. And we are choosing to do things in this country, on the left and the right and in the middle, that I believe are taking us down a suicidal path. My friend Charles Krauthammer, you know, died last year. He gave a very famous speech called Decline is a Choice. We are choosing to do things. We're choosing to basically teach kids to turn their backs on all the good parts of American history. We are choosing not to teach civics. We are choosing not to teach gratitude. Instead, we teach ingratitude. We teach kids the opposite of gratitude, which is entitlement, that they're owed something from the day they're born by the society. We don't teach them how much better things have gotten. And that is a suicidal choice, because if you don't teach people to be grateful for things, if you don't teach people to appreciate the society that they live in, they have no investment to sustain it and hand it off to the next generation. They think it's all disposable. And it's not disposable. For 250,000 years, the average human being everywhere in the world lived on $3 a day or less. And only once in all of human history that started to change. And it happened about 300 years ago, starting in England, spreading to America, now spreading around the world. We right now live in the greatest moment of poverty alleviation in all of human history. No one's talking about it. No one's grateful for it.
Well, that's the thing, is it's hard to teach all that positive messaging when in the general culture, social media, regular media, whatever you want to say, is largely negative.
I agree. But there's no alternative. The only way you preserve things is with upkeep. And so that goes for civilizations, too. So either you choose to fight for the civilization or you choose to let it go.
Joan, it's been really good to talk to you.
It's been
really
great
fun
to
meet you, too. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Jonah Goldberg, senior editor of the National Review, author most recently of the book we talked about, Suicide of the West. He also holds a chair in Applied Liberty at the American Enterprise Institute, and he's a nationally known commentator. You probably heard him many times on NPR. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.